At the request of my two doctoral students who are finishing up this year and preparing for such things as job interviews and the like, and they were very, very interested to hear what I had to say, as if they hadn't heard it regularly for weeks and weeks and weeks and months. And maybe it's the Friday afternoon sessions that have caused them to forget it. First of all, it's always a major honor to be asked to come to another university and talk, and I really consider it a major honor to be here today and also to be talking about teaching this evening. There's when a person who is a faculty member gets in the sciences actually gets asked to say anything at all formally about education, then that's the highest form of flattery, and I hope it happens to you all. I'm really, really honored to be here. What I'd like to do is figure out how to do that. I'm going to talk this afternoon about maybe 30 years worth of work and try to tie together some of the ideas that have been sort of discussed over and over and over again years and years ago in my lab, and finally put into some kind of practice by one of the most remarkable graduate students that I know, one of them named Scott Snyder, who's now on the faculty at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and the other one, Matt Bullock, who's now at Oklahoma State University. So much of the actual real parasite life cycle evolution comes from those two gentlemen. What I'm going to do is begin with a little bit of introduction into a trematode called Postdiplostoma minimum that occurs as a larval form in Fundulus abrius. And we did about a 14-year study of this starting back in the early 80s. And this whole study that involved a number of parasite species is really where the ideas you're going to hear today came from. I'll go on then and talk a little bit about frog lung flukes of the genus Hematolecus, and particularly life cycle diversity, and especially such things as the avenues for colonization of hosts and the factors that tend to direct or constrain the movement of parasites through an ecosystem. The baseball metaphor is pretty easy, and I'll deal with that very quickly. And then hopefully I'll have time to talk a little bit about a simulation model that we've been working on lately. And this model really goes back to the time that Marianne was a graduate student and working on and taking a course, I think, in community ecology, and did some work then on trematode life cycle model. So the Postdiplostoma minimum system. This is a site out in the Platte River, South Platte River, near Roscoe, Nebraska, where we've done a great deal of work. This river is running right now at about 200 cubic feet per second, and cubic feet per second is the unit in which the State Department of Water Resources measures or records stream flow in all of the state lakes and streams where it actually has gauges. Now, right behind these kids, almost from where the picture was taken, there is a gauging station. So we have really daily stream flow for the last 25 or 30 years of the South Platte River near Roscoe. Keeping in mind then that stream flow is the major factor in dictating the nature of the transmission environment. Let me go back to this one right here. For those of you that don't know trematode life cycles, this particular one is adults and fish-eating birds. Eggs are shed in the feces. They're picked up by snails. They undergo two or three generations of asexual reproduction in snails. The cercarial stages, or the larval stages, leave. They penetrate these fish, and the number of parasites in these small fish, the larval stages, which are look something like that, can number into the hundreds depending on the year. So when I talk about prevalence and abundance of these things in Fundulus, we're really talking about larval stages. This figure talks about the two things. One of them is the snowpack in the Rocky Mountains. This is an average of 600 stations on the Front Range. And what you'll see, and this line right here is the floating 40-year average. The yellow line then is stream flow of the South Platte River, and the picture you saw was similar to something right along in here. And what this particular picture tells you is that the stream that we all know really is that Rocky Mountain snowpack is what really determines then the annual sort of average stream flow in this river. So, for example, down here in 1990, this would be a case where for the whole year, every single solitary day, taken into account, that river was flowing about like you saw it in that picture with those two students. And when it's up in here, it's about 10 or 12 feet deep, flowing about 15 or 20 miles an hour, and bank to bank, and extraordinarily dangerous. So the next picture you're going to see then is the prevalence or the percent infected in these fish of postdiploma stoma minimum as a function then of stream flow. And what this one shows and the abundance of that parasite in those fish also follows exactly the same line is that the prevalence then lags stream flow by a year or two. And when the stream flow goes up into flood stage, it simply washes out all of the snails and washes out all the Sicaria and reduces it, definitive host use of the river. And the parasites, after the fish tend to die off, if the stream flow stays up, then the conditions for transmission are essentially eliminated and the parasite disappears. And once the stream flow goes down, snail populations build up, the parasite population itself build up in the fish. So what's really happening here, and this is where the ideas of success, and particularly evolutionary success, that we talk about in terms of reproduction and numbers. What's really happening is that the success of this parasite in this particular system is regulated by Rocky Mountain snowpack, and we really don't have a whole lot of understanding of what it is that regulates Rocky Mountain snowpack. It could be movement of moisture and air out over the Pacific River, or pardon me, over the Pacific Ocean. But nevertheless, in terms of looking at a phenomenon that really controls the life of this parasite, it's something that's a distant geological phenomenon, meteorological phenomenon. So in this particular case, instead of such things that you would normally think of as a community ecologist, things like competition between co-occurring parasites or host resistance or something of the sort, what's really controlling this success is this combination of atmospheric phenomena that produces snow in the Rocky Mountains, and it's doing it then by dictating the avenues for colonization that are present or not present in this fish. So this kind of consideration then of life cycle and the flow of parasite tissue through ecosystems leads to really the broader question of what factors actually dictate the flow of these parasites. And so we took a look then at, or maybe I should say I was successful in convincing a couple of very unusual individuals to start taking a look at the case of congeneric lung flukes in frogs. Now, this particular image, I have no idea where Matt got it, but he uses it in every one of his slideshows, including the first picture and the last picture, and I figured I couldn't really talk about his research without showing it. I'm sure he stole it off the web someplace. So here's what I would call an archetypical picture, a paradigmatic picture of a frog lung fluke life cycle, the one that I just sort of explained. Frogs, lung fluke eggs are shed in the feces, they're picked up, eaten by snails, several cycles of asexual reproduction goes place in here. The Sicaria are eliminated, they burrow out through the wall of the snail, go through the water, in the what I would call a paradigmatic life cycle, they get sucked into the rectal gills of dragonfly larvae, this thing metamorphoses, frog eats the dragonfly, and this seems very, very natural and logical, and this is the one that's in all the textbooks. Real world life looks a little bit different. There are at least six species of North American frog lung flukes, distinguished mainly by the relative sizes of their abdominal suckers and the distribution of vitellaria up and down the sides and the placement of the testes. There are over 500 species of dragonflies. There are at least 12 species of snails that serve as first intermediate hosts for these frog lung flukes. There are about 20-21 species of anurans in North America. So the real thing looks more like this than the textbook picture. And so the problem of parasite flow through an ecosystem is far more complex and potentially influenced by factors other than the ones you might think of. If the only thing that was in your mind was the paradigmatic archetypical life cycle. So what Matt and Scott did over about a 6 or 7 year period was bring virtually all of this into the laboratory. And that includes rearing 6 or 7 different species of anurans from tadpoles, included rearing a number of species of two different families of snails from eggs, so that there were parasite-free, known parasite-free snail populations. In the case of Matt, at least, involved bringing a whole number of these different kinds of invertebrates into the lab, keeping them alive for weeks and sometimes months to do experimental infections. That involved a study of what happens to these parasites during metamorphosis of the adults. And finally, it involved some molecular work involving the adult worms themselves. I'm going to talk really only about the stuff, the second intermediate hosts, just as an example of how this work was sort of done. And the question that then comes up is, what's the role of these second intermediate hosts, these odonates, and their parasite interactions in the transmission of these lung flukes? Well, here's the situation. There are a couple of these Haemataelicus medioplexus and Haemataelicus varioplexus that are specialists in the sense that they only infect dragonflies, and so they get sucked into the rectal chamber and cysts in here. And while I'm on this subject, they also tend to get lost as these things molt, and so the hindgut then gets lost. And so these things not only come into the dragonflies, but they get dumped every time those dragonflies molt. So there's a whole lot of parasite loss that in the system that's a result of the actual choice, quote unquote, of places to infect. There's Haemataelicus longiplexus, which infects both dragonflies and damselflies, and it gets sucked in like the others. But also, in the case of damselfly naiads, which really do not have this same breathing pattern, these particular cercaria gather right there at the posterior end and work their way into the gut along the in the anus and in the membranes that surround those gills. And they also tend to incyst in the body cavity. Haemataelicus complexus and another related species, Haemataelicus coloradensis, these things, however, are generalists, and they will infect virtually all kinds of aquatic inverts, regardless, crustaceans, beetles, you name it. And all of these, however, the cercarial stages have these stylus, and they have different numbers then and amounts of penetration glands, but this is generally what frog lung flukes look like. So here's an example of Matt going to the field, picking up 140 or so young of the year, and these are tiny, tiny little leopard frogs, snout vent length of about an inch and a half, and examined. And what he's finding, and he also did some stomach contents. So what he finds is that three quarters of them, at least half of them are infected. And not only are they infected, but they have mature worms in them, which means that essentially as soon as that little frog gets its gut rearranged and reconstricted following metamorphosis, then it starts feeding on tiny, tiny little invertebrates that are infected. And another, it keeps another 60 or so in the lab for a month and a half, and then goes back and harvests each and every one of those worms, runs them up to permanent slides, and discovers that they are Haematurgicus complexus. So the important thing, at least in this case, is to remember that here's a group of frogs with this one species, Haematurgicus complexus, that get infected when they are really tiny. And when you start looking then at the paradigmatic life cycle picture, you realize that that picture, if you're talking about that frog and this species, that picture really demands then that this thing eats stuff that is quite a bit bigger than it. So this is one case where the ability to infect things other than dragonflies and damselflies creates an avenue for colonization or infection, or an avenue by which this parasite tissue flows through the ecosystem into these tiny, tiny little frogs. Stomach content looks something like this. These little frogs eat a whole lot of different stuff, but the potential intermediate hosts are really aquatic coleopterans, aquatic bugs, true bugs, amphipods, in this case mainly Hyalella, and tiny little odonates. And so if you kind of take out the terrestrial beetles that they eat and blow this up a little bit, this is what it looks like. So what's really happening here is that these things are eating, instead of necessarily the odonates that are out of the even the tiny little ones, odonates that are out of the paradigmatic life cycle, they're really getting their parasites in different kinds of ways. If you look at stomach contents and just simply go out into the field and collect several hundred aquatic insects and start looking at them, you realize that there is a whole lot of infection in these things. But really, this whole, with respect to this species right here, this whole bunch of larvae are really not accessible to the hosts of choice in this case, and these groups that are outlined in red are. Now, the ability to penetrate is really the primary difference. In fact, it's essentially the only difference in these different species, so that in Haematurgicus complexus, this penetration ability really provides an avenue for colonization of these young of the year leopard frogs and directs the flow of parasite tissue into them. Haematurgicus longiplexus, this penetration ability is highly restricted, so that it ends up in hosts that are able to eat the larger damselflies and dragonflies. And medioplexus and varioplexus then lack this penetration ability altogether, and so they are really constrained to the large predators. Okay. To put this stuff in a little bit of a phylogenetic context, we pick up some data from Scott Snyder and Vossel Falk involving most of this is ITS and small subunit ribosomal DNA, and that paper is from 2001. And Matt has added then a few of these specimens, a few of these analyses from Wisconsin. The way these gentlemen do this stuff, I should tell you, for those of you that may not be taxonomists, the issue of deciding what species a worm belongs to is not a trivial issue at all, and especially in the case of trematodes, where very often they get prepared in different ways. Sometimes they get smashed, sometimes they get killed in boiling water, sometimes they get killed in vials with formalin shaken up, and it's not always clear then that what a person is calling one species is actually the true species that they're dealing with. Matt and Scott both started every one of their collections then by cutting a little wedge out of the posterior part of this, these worms, which are not very long, and fixing that, putting that in alcohol, using that for their molecular work, and then treating the rest of the worm in a very standard sort of a museum consistent way. And so the link between morphology and the sequences is really very, very, I think we're pretty confident in that at the time. So what you're seeing then is this group down here, Hematolycus coloridensis and Hematolycus complexus, that go through about everything. You're seeing medial plexus and parvovirus plexus, among these that go through only the large odonates, and you're seeing the longa plexus that goes through both the damselflies and the dragonflies. So if you start putting those hosts together, what you really find in the outgroups, incidentally, down here are plagiorchids, and these are ones that have all have essentially penetrating cicaria. So the penetration itself is something that we interpret as being the plesiomorphic or the ancestral character. Some of this stuff is European, but here we have sort of a partial penetration. Here we have those species that are restricted then to the larger odonates, and finally those that end up in a whole variety of invertebrates, including a European form, Variegatus. So the assumption is here then that this whole penetration and access to small second intermediate hosts probably antedates the breakup of Pangaea, and this loss of penetrating behavior then is an acquisition, the typical of North America. In terms of the actual host specificity for the definitive host, bullfrogs and green frogs are pretty closely related. And what we see then is that the green frog turns out to really pick up all of these from virtually every different direction, every available host. And this is all done experimentally with lab-reared frogs from tadpoles. The bullfrog, however, is not susceptible to complexus coloridensis or medial plexus. So we also have, in addition to the flow of parasite material into various second intermediate hosts as a result of cicarial behavior, we also have the issue of the origin, really, of host specificity or host resistance in the case of the frogs. Leopard frogs, however, pick up just about everything, but in general, they are infected by these two down here. So the general lack of these things in nature and being infected with these other species in nature is an ecological phenomenon, whereas this one right here is really related to behavior of the cicaria. So sort of the take home then is that this paradigmatic life cycle really sort of hides a whole lot of host and parasite biology that ultimately is a fair amount of evolutionary importance, especially when you start asking what defines success in a particular system. I think the metaphors are things that scientists don't always give adequate attention to, and so the question is of what is really the appropriate metaphor for the system that we're studying, in this case frog lung flukes. It is also a question that asks, where do your questions come from? And I think that the whole practice thinking about nature in a particular way tends to shape our choices of things to study, tends to affect our problems that we consider valid or legitimate ones. And I believe that we tend to do that far more than we admit. And those life cycle diagrams that seem so simple and so straightforward, I think, tend to focus our attention on things that may or may not be of substantial importance out there in nature. Well, the baseball metaphor is really pretty straightforward, and this comes from a from a former student named Richard Clopton, who was asking sort of the same kinds of questions. What's the best metaphor? Is it the economic metaphor, the business model, the competition, you know, the football metaphor? What is it? And in this case, I'm fairly convinced that the baseball metaphor is really the best one. And if we start thinking about such things, we start thinking about the divergence of parasite life cycles and where the energy goes in terms of the construction of tissue, we might ask such questions like, what would happen to a baseball team if every batter really tried to hit a home run, regardless of the situation, or if every batter that got on first base would steal? And so this would be kind of the analogy or the rough equivalent of a trematode committing evolutionarily to a certain function in its life cycle. So this really then brings us to some host parasite encounter models with a question of where should a trematode invest its energy, or really what defines success in terms of these trematode life cycles. And of course, it's impossible from watching those guys work. I would say it's certainly a lifetime. First thing you would need to do is win Powerball, a big Powerball. Second thing you need is access to frog lung flukes, probably in some place like Southeast Texas, and a lot of time and a lot of space to really demand. In fact, you'd almost have to have a zoo to do this. but you can do it in a computer fairly quickly. I will admit that these models are really so simple. I'm not a heavy-duty programmer. I'm not a very skillful one, and my models tend to start resembling the great American novel after a while, with the amount of code. But they're based on some very sort of simple null ideas. First of these is that interactions between parasites and hosts occur in some kind of a two-dimensional space, and you can make hosts and put them out there in that space, and you can make parasites, put them out there in that space, and if they end up close enough, then one infects the other. So that's really the sort of the basic attributes. We assume that encounters are random. We assume that infectivity is a function of proximity. If the parasite gets close enough, it infects. The operator can vary host and parasite numbers and a whole bunch of other attributes, sort of depending on what kind of equations you want to put in. You can allow your infectivity to be varied. You can allow barriers to be erected. You can, you know, put in different parasite reproductive methods. You can put in competition if you want to, a whole variety of things. So this is the model that we're working with now. And we've really asked, what happens to the adult worm population when you hold each of these constant except one? And then what does this one step do to the entire system? So what we have is a definitive host. We have inside the adult in there. This thing is shedding eggs, so you can vary the number here. The actual infection of an egg with a snail occurs in a spatial arena. Once the snail gets infected, then this step is the production of sporocysts and daughter sporocysts. Once you get these produced, then you can dictate the number or the variation in the number of redia that are produced. Once you get these produced, then you can vary the number of Sercaria produced and their probability of survival. And then, once you produce the Sercaria, the encounter with the second intermediate host becomes, again, a matter of spatial interaction. And finally, we get some predate. We can insert a predator in here that eats these things or encounters them, encounters them spatially. And if they encounter, the predator encounters the second intermediate host, then we assume that infection occurs. So we can then start looking at the points at which selection can occur. And the answer is it can occur in any of these things. So adult parasites can evolve in a variety of ways. So all of these stages are really potential targets for selection. The kinds of forces that might be acting on those include things like host immunity or resistance or physiology and biochemistry. This would be the adult worm in the frog, there are a whole bunch of abiotic factors that might affect the egg or the myristidium itself. The snail itself, the first intermediate host, they also tend to vary in their resistance, sometimes with competing parasite species. So there's a long list of these, and each point has its own selective force. Potential parasite responses include surface proteins, maturation rate, egg production, what have you. For the eggs, eggshell chemistry, stored energy reserves, hatching cues, that sort of thing. Numbers and rates of germ ball production on the intrasnail stages of the life cycle. So in putting all this stuff together, what we really did was started with a set of values that would give what you call a kind of a typical parasite distribution among hosts, and then we started manipulating the various investments. So what we have here are 10 different worms, in which we've actually kept the adults, and what you're seeing, these are parasite for host classes. So what we really wanted to do was get this kind of a frequency distribution that's sort of classically described in the parasite literature with the negative binomial equations. The ecologists tend to look at these things and realize very quickly that the negative binomial has no obvious biological function or analogy or homology. I mean, you really can't go into that equation and ask yourself, what do these terms really apply to in terms of real animals? But nevertheless, it's a very good descriptive tool. And generally, in these frequency distributions that you see in nature, the majority of hosts are either very lightly infected or not infected at all, and a few hosts then are heavily infected, so that the majority of the parasites in your system tend to end up in a very few of the hosts. And so in certain cases in the literature, modern literature at least, on parasite population distribution, you find some of these as being called the super infectors, or the ones that are really responsible for most of the parasitism. So what we really did then was start with a set of values that would give something like this, and then started manipulating all these things separately. So here's an example of egg production versus some parasite population parameter values. So when you ask yourself what happens in the adult worm population if the parasite evolves in a way that it eventually produces 10 times as many eggs as it is now, and that's what this is all about. And the answer is fairly simple. You produce really a lot of adult worms, and your average number of worms per host goes up, and your prevalence goes up, but they don't go up very far. So this is really fewer than. So even though you have an order of magnitude increase in the production of your eggs, you really never get prevalence above half of the hosts infected. However, if you look at the population structure then of your adults worms in the definitive host, you realize that one of the things that when you give it 10 times as many eggs, then you actually produce some more heavily infected hosts out here, so that this whole phenomenon where a few hosts tend to contribute most of the next generation tends to be a product of egg production. On the other hand, if you ask yourself about a different life cycle stage, such as population structures in adults resulting from different sporocyst multipliers, if you just simply increase 5 times the number of sporocysts that you actually produce within the snail, and keeping in mind that within the snail these parasites have access to really a substantial amount of energy, what happens to your adult worm population? The answer is not very much. So this is an investment that, if made from an evolutionary point of view, would not really have a great payoff. Similarly, if you ask yourself what happens if you increase the number of cicerae that you're producing, and the average, and the answer is again even though you increase your average number of parasites per host in the adult population, and even though your prevalence goes up a little bit, you can multiply this four times, and your prevalence really doesn't go up over half. And again, you don't get very many heavily infected adult frogs or adult hosts, definitive hosts. So this is how we're sort of working on this model to figure out. Oh, sorry, I left that figure 9 in. This is a graph I took out of a paper that we're getting ready to submit. Sorry about that, folks. If one of my students did that, I'd be furious. And we can also then look at such things on this model by adjusting it a little bit in the way it runs. Look at the cumulative effects, or the effects of worm longevity on the adult host worm population. And it turned, and I've converted those bar graphs into line graphs, even though that's not entirely graphically correct, but it's easier to read that way. And the simple truth is that in all of these simulations, the one thing that really tends to increase the number of heavily infected hosts, regardless of whether it increases the mean or the prevalence, is longevity of one of the life cycle stages, especially the adults or the metasecarial stage. And so when you go then to the literature and start looking at papers to see if there are data to allow you to address some questions about how, whether or not this sort of idea works in nature, you don't really find it very well. But if you go to the laboratory infections, then what you realize is that adult worms tend to live a very long time. And in the case of our original parasites, such as Postodiplostoma minimum in fish, these things live as long as the fish lives. And furthermore, the lack of host specificity at that particular stage, and there are almost 100 different species of fish that have been shown to be susceptible to Postodiplostoma minima, that lack of host specificity can probably be considered a mimic or an equivalent then of longevity at that particular stage. So the question is then, what are the keys to success if you're a trematode? And actually the most effective way then for increase both prevalence and mean number of worms and the heavily infected hosts are to live longer, and that's really the key. So you would predict that those parasites that are not long-lived as adults end up having metasecharia that are, and as best we can tell from the literature, that's exactly the case with Postodiplostoma minimum. And in the baseball metaphor then, persistence and choice of when to run are really the keys to success. Well, there have been a lot of people who've actually worked in our lab on and off and contributed to the overall atmosphere and the number of ideas that have circulated around. Matt Bullock, Scott Snyder, our two, Gabe Langford and Elaine Knives are my current graduate students. Gabe is doing some of this exact same kind of work with Rhabdius species in snakes and frogs, the nematode. Elaine is doing some similar work with Dactyl gyrus species in some converging streams in Lancaster County. Jim and Lee Sillison are landowners, and actually Dwayne and Lois Dunwoody and Randy Peterson, all of those folks are landowners out in western Nebraska who have simply opened up their property and said, come and study anything you want to study. Cedar Point Biological Station is where most of this work has actually been done. I think I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. The question is, on this model, have we tried changing more than one at a time? And the answer is yes. I could probably, let me just put that back up there and see what we can do. We've done an awful lot of that kind of stuff. For example, we've done things like increase the eggs as we've decreased the probability of infecting a second intermediate host. So we've put in some what you might call response to environmental changes, you know, sort of, and that tends to show that it doesn't really. It does. If you reduce the probability of infection down here, then you can increase the eggs as much as you want to, and it doesn't do much good for you. So that's the main thing we've done, and we've done a lot of sort of repeated iterations of this, where you run this 30 times, and then increase the variability of this. Probability of this infection. So, and the idea being to try to see what happens when you what is the best response of the parasite to a highly variable transmission condition. And so, we've done a lot of that, and that's the main stuff we've done. Yeah, it's. This particular paper is about, I would say, 90% ready, and hopefully, I've been vowing to get it in before Christmas, but that may not happen. I mean, that's when you get to be my age, you can afford to vow things like that. Yes, Marianne.
I'm curious. So, if you talk about success in the life cycle. But if you increase the infection so much so that, you have a lot more hosts that are harboring a lot more parasites, can that affect the longevity of the host? And if so, does it ever kind of run out?
The answer is, does the cycle ever run out? If you
get so infected that you die? Or
we haven't done that, but we could pretty easily. I mean, that's about two statements. When you get it for every adult that gets up here, just kill them off. Yeah. No, that's a very good idea. Yeah, that's a good one.
Any more questions?
Mike.
That was specificity. I'm always really intrigued with notions of sort of an assumption that these things are so exquisitely co-evolved and there's this host-parasite interaction is so fine-tuned. How much do you think host specificity is overrated, or it really reflects circumstance more than surface?
So the question is, how much do I think that host specificity relies on exquisite co-evolutionary phenomena as opposed to good luck?
Yeah.
The one piece of modeling that my graduate students and I have been talking about, and I don't know whether when you all were there, this has been what, 15 years? I think when you all were there, I'm not sure we were actually using the term the crapshoot theory.
No, I think we're still calling something a little more sophisticated.
Yeah, but since then it's been, we've been talking about this. Gabe and Matt and I don't remember whether Scott, but all of the students in our lab, we've been using this phrase, the crapshoot theory, and just threatening to actually write that paper, and we can't figure out how to do it. So the point is, if you're a frog lung fluke, okay, let's just say you're a frog lung fluke metasecaria, and you have five or six different species of frogs to fall into, and that frog eats your second intermediate host. Okay, that there's a good chance that if it's the right species, then you're going to infect that frog. But if it's the wrong species of frog, like the bullfrog instead of the green frog, you're not going to. Or the cricket frog instead of the leopard frog, something like this. And yet, those frogs, physiologically and biochemically, are much closer to one another than any of them is to, say, a mammal or a lizard, even. And so the crapshoot part of this says that perhaps there's something going on in this whole life cycle, genetically, evolutionarily, that produces a parasite that survives when it just is lucky enough to get to the right place. And whether or not that, you know, is a result of something that the host has, you know, that's happened to the host, I don't know. But this whole idea of exquisite coevolution, I think, is something that somebody needs to explore a little bit. Now, the other thing that I could have talked about today, but essentially chose not to, at Mary Ann's encouraging, was all of this work we're doing with parasites of insects. And the Jill Detweiler paper that just came out earlier this year, what she really did was she took several species of flower beetles, several species of Tribolium and Pylorus subdepressus, and took all of their Gregorian parasites, these are apicomplexan parasites, took all of those and did experimental cross-infections in all of those different beetles. So, you know, she had a row of targets and a row of sources and filled in the grid, and it took her 3 years. And the truth is that some of those will go into places that have no bearing whatsoever on the best, on where they should go according to the best phylogeny we currently have of Tribolium. So they would go, you know, cross branches. We also have a Tribolium species in the lab, Tribolium maidens, that will not accept any of these parasites, either as the larva or the adult. And then we have some of these parasites in essentially the same genus, supposedly Gregorina, that will go into almost every one of those beetles. So there's something going on in this little sample of 7 or 8 species and 3 genera of Tenebrionids, of which there are 15,000 species. But these, you know, this handful of ones that we have, there's something going on that directs the movement of those parasites into different species, sort of independent of where they fall on an evolutionary, on a phylogeny. And to my knowledge, that's the only study that's ever been done in which you have all of these related forms, and some of them congeners and all confamilials, in which this host specificity stuff has been done experimentally. So there's something to be explored, and I'm not sure I know what it is.
Yeah, I have a question. In certainly in ectoparasites, the groups that I work with, find that there sort of has been a tradition of people applying names, different species names of parasites found on different hosts, right, which under scrutiny turn out to be the same.
Yeah.
And since you're doing both molecular work and morphological work in trematodes, I'm curious if you find that when you analyze some of these things molecularly, that you discover that trematodes, which in fact are considered to be the same, are sometimes different, and vice versa, where different species have simply been named that way because they were found in different hosts, but are not genetically different.
That's exactly, yeah, you're right. That's exactly what's happened with, so the question is, to what extent have some of these trematodes been shown to be the same species when they were, by molecular work, when they were formally shown to be, or thought to be different, and vice versa. And that's exactly what's happened with some of these. If you go back to these, to the Snyder phylogenies, excuse me, I'll go back to his paper, you'll see that some of these are polytomies. And historically, this case with Coloradensis and Complexus, this is a case where on the basis of morphology, these things have been either split or merged, depending on who the author is. And so that's clearly a case, and it's still not a very well-resolved case. There's one of these others. There's a parvate plexus. There's some confusion morphologically, if I remember this correctly, between the parvate plexus and the varial plexus stuff, even though those are come out sort of in different places molecularly. So I think for anybody working with whole organisms, the issue of what's the right character is one that plagues us all the time, and it's the one question that I believe can get answered pretty well by the molecular work, at least in times. So yeah, this happens, and I guess the other issue is how many people are working on these kind of things, and the answer is not nearly as many as you need to really resolve the questions. There's some great stuff by a guy named Paul Nolan on flukes, and these are plagiorchid flukes that involved radio labeling of sperm and taking different species and putting them in the same host and to find out who mated with whom. And it turns out that at least in some cases, you can get some crossbreeding that what you would think would be different species. But it's been a while since I've looked at that Nolan work. The question is, how do you find frogs that are free of parasites, or where do you find them?
How often?
Not terribly often, but the tadpoles, if you're going to work with frogs experimentally, you have to rear them from tadpoles. But frogs that are totally free of frog lung flukes depends entirely on where you collect them. As a general rule, if you have all of the components there, so the right species of frog and a healthy intermediate host population, then you're going to have frog lung flukes of some kind. And depending on where you are in the country, you may also have a lot of nematode parasites. They tend to be restricted, not necessarily restricted, but much more prevalent in moister areas of the country. For example, you go to western Nebraska where it's very arid, you really don't find these frogs infected with nematodes that burrow through the skin or have to survive in moist soil.
If these nematodes are defeating something in the host and you have them free of that, would you then develop sort of giant frogs?
Oh, would you develop giant frogs? I don't know. My sense is that that frogs, just like the rest of us, are sort of limited by their genetic makeup about how big they're going to get.
I think you'll be feeding their
well, you know, the strange thing is you can go out and collect 50 frogs and they all look about the same, and some of them will have 50 worms in their lungs and some won't. And so, you know, you're hard-pressed to say that something like that's happening.
Okay, I think we're going to have a safe voice. We have another seminar later, and we have a parting gift. It's always difficult to decide what kind of gifts to give. We give you a Notre Dame beer mug or a football helmet.
You gave me a Notre Dame t-shirt one time that I actually wear.
Well, I think you might actually get another one.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all.